Monster Man, special episode, Prey Deities. Hello, and welcome to Monster Man, a show about monsters, because monsters are great. I'm James Holloway, and I'm reading my way through the gaming books of yesteryear. And as I do, I'm taking a look at the monsters that I find in them, their history, their mythology, their ecology, their imagery, and how to use them in games. Today's episode is a special episode brought to you by the generosity and public spirit of my Patreon backers, and in particular of Patreon backer Andrew. If you'd like to be like Andrew and get your own special episode, all you gotta do is go to patreon.com/monsterman and pledge at the $5 level. And if you do that, you'll also get access to my other podcast, Patron Deities, which has a lot in common with today's episode. Now I know, if you care about this stuff, which I don't think most people do, but it bothers me, that at the end of last episode, I promised a different episode this time. That is because episodes are sometimes recorded pretty far in advance, and then scheduling changes can make my announcements false. I apologize for that. I think if I hadn't mentioned it, I could have got away with it because both patrons are in fact named Andrew. Just to change the order that episodes are coming out in to fit with the schedule of the book I'll be talking about in that special episode. Okay, so Andrew has asked me to talk about the deities of prey species, and he talked about sort of little crummy guys like kobolds and whatnot, but primarily about Richard Adams' 1972 novel, Watership Down. Now, Watership Down, I have to admit, I had not engaged with in a long time. You know, I saw the animated film when I was a kid. I'm aware that there's more than one animated version of Watership Down, but the 1978, or whenever it was, one is the one that I'm most familiar with, or familiar with at all. And I read the novel, but again, you know, when I was a kid, I haven't gone back and looked at it in decades. I think, particularly if you're British, Watership Down is one of those kind of things that traumatized you when you were a kid. You know, I'm not sure that my generation of children who grew up in America has an equivalent to, there's a category in British media of things that traumatized you when you were a kid, right? Watership Down, Ghost Watch, Threads. And I'm not sure that there's the equivalent for my generation of people who grew up in America. For a previous generation, of course, it was Bambi. Anyway, so Watership Down, as I say, 1972 novel, tells the story of a group of rabbits on a perilous journey to set up a new warren, and it is sort of interspersed with stories from the mythology of the rabbits, and that's what we're going to be looking at in today's episode. So these tales focus mainly on the adventures of El Herrera. I'm going with what Richard Adams said was the correct way to pronounce it. I think everybody just says El Herrera. It was simplified in the movie, right? It's just called El Herrera or something in the movie. Again, it's not when I was a kid. He is the kind of culture hero of the rabbits. And he is cunning and resourceful and determined, but a hero for a species that doesn't have like a drive or the ability, I guess, to kind of like conquer and overcome. So in the central myth of the saga, the sun god Frith tries to get El Herrera to stop his people from overrunning the earth. They're breeding, if you will, like rabbits. And when he's denied, Frith then goes ahead and grants gifts to all the other animals, you know, cats and weasels and so on, and gives them like sharp teeth and the ability to see in the dark so that they can hunt rabbits. And then he gives El Herrera some gifts to compensate, right? So speed, digging, keen senses, etc. This creates a balance. So the rabbits won't overrun the earth, but they also won't be completely wiped out. And this is summarized in Frith's like message to you, El Herrera, which is, El Herrera, your people cannot rule the world, for I will not have it so. All the world will be your enemy, prince with 1,000 enemies, and whenever they catch you, they will kill you. But first, they must catch you, digger, listener, runner, prince with a swift warning. Be cunning and full of tricks, and your people shall never be destroyed. So Frith, the sun god, and sort of the supreme god of this cosmology, has guaranteed that rabbits as a whole will never be wiped out, but he has not guaranteed the safety of any particular rabbit. And this is sort of key to the way that rabbits experience the world, right? These are stories that reflect their worldview, the worldview of prey. Asterisk. I like the fact that the rabbits have a creation myth in which they are present at the dawn of time in this novel that is obviously set in England. My understanding is that rabbits are an intrusive species in England. They only actually came over here about 1,000 years ago or so. Which, I mean, okay, that's a long time, but it's not exactly the dawn of creation. Anyway, whatever. Creation myth does not reflect historical reality. Hold the front page. So, El Herrera is a fascinating example of a deity who varies from the usual templates, or rather, I mean, okay, deity, hero, whatever, a mythological figure. It's not that there aren't these kinds of cunning trickster figures in a lot of mythologies, because of course there are. What's unusual is to have this character put in the central place. He's very explicitly not the most powerful being around, and he has to rely on wits and cunning to escape more powerful beings. And this role of being someone who outwits rather than overpowers is one that is very sort of typically associated with rabbits. So examples of this type of rabbit trickster would be like Br'er Rabbit or Bugs Bunny. Rabbits are wily and they elude the people who want to hurt them. There's never a sense that like Bugs Bunny is going to stand his ground and duke it out with Elmer Fudd. And that makes sense. If you're in a vulnerable position like that, you might prize not the power to overcome enemies, but the wit and skill to avoid them. You elevate the trickster to this position if you don't have the option to fight back, and if you kind of have a little bit of a feeling that the supreme deity gave your people a pretty raw deal. Now, as this relates to fantasy monsters, I don't think it's very easy to draw a direct parallel, because implicit, I think, in being a monster is the idea of some sense of menace. And if there is one thing that rabbits do not possess, it is a sense of menace. Unless you're, like, some clover, I guess. So in D&D, maybe not so much in D&D, but as in the discourse around D&D, and the discourse around fantasy gaming in general, there is this image of, you know, adventurers massacring caves full of orc babies. And obviously somebody probably played that way at some point. But I think the trend of the game and of games in general has been to move away from that for a long time, because people like to play characters who feel heroic. Even if they're playing characters who are evil, for the most part, they like to play characters who are overcoming odds. Our sympathies naturally rest with the underdog. And so when the adventurers are hunting down and trying to kill or capture might be interesting, but when the adventurers are hunting down and trying to kill some like weak little creature and all it's doing is running away and using ingenuity, well, that is a story in which it is the good guy and the players are the bad guys. And even if they're in some other sense good guys, they feel like bullies. So most fantasy monsters are threatening in some way. Now for player characters, that's another story and we'll get to that later. Think about the idea of applying something like this to kobolds. I don't know that it really works. Maybe for some of your smaller, weaker humanoids, your germlings and such, they're so essentially defenseless. Although, obviously, they're not defenseless. But, you know, compared to other creatures, you can see why they might feel that way. You can see them having a trickster as their sort of their great hero, their role model. But I think if you go a little higher up the hit dice ladder, you're going to get more of a mixed picture. So in a fight, a rabbit doesn't have anything it can do against a dog, right? Like there's a Labrador in Watership Down, and the rabbits react like it is Godzilla. They are completely unequipped to do anything but run against this thing. And the one character who sort of refuses to run away in this fight, this is treated as evidence for why that guy's not right. There's something wrong with him. But if you are a humanoid, no matter how low on the food chain, you have some options, right? You might be a Gripply, right? Gripply don't exactly chill the blood with terror. And in a stand-up fight against a hobgoblin, a Gripply is going down. But by using teamwork or strategy or just having exceptional individual skill, Gripply might be able to take down a hobgoblin. And so therefore, the option of fighting enters. And so now we have, instead of a character who just has to run away and that's how it works, so it's great that he's good at it, we have a character who's making the choice to run away, which is different. Now, what you might have, I think, is a very important role for the trickster in your pantheon. You know, the merfolk can outfight the sahuagin if they box clever, but misdirection of fast swimming is probably a better bet, and it would make sense that they had some kind of, like, patron of misdirection of fast swimming in their mythology to use as an example for why people who don't even hit and run but just run are embodying principles of their mythology. It could even be a sequential thing or a conflict, right? So maybe you have some merfolk who grew up in Sahuagin waters, and for them, seeking cover and hiding, that's always the right move. And then there might be other merfolk who hate that belief, you know, who see this fleeing every time you see the shape of a Sahuagin in the distance as cowardly or shameful. It's a little like Mercutio in Romeo and Juliet. Oh, calm, dishonorable, vile submission. But the advocates of swimming away would say, look what happened to Mercutio. I do think that this idea works well in an overpowered world. So if giants or Martian war machines are rampaging everywhere, then all the real hardcore devotees of the god of proud defiance are wearing their expiration dates pretty openly. You know, you might wind up with a society where the trickster, once a marginal figure in the pantheon, winds up being central because it's his blessings that permit people to thrive in a world where everything can step on you. This reminds me a little bit of the conversation that the protagonist has with the soldier in The War of the Worlds, where he's talking about, you know, humanity surviving kind of in the cracks and around the edges of a world dominated by the Martians. Maybe the way to get more prey gods into your RPG is to redefine everybody as prey. Now, I want to zoom in specifically on kobolds because this is rare. I want to push back a little bit against this argument because I think that kobolds are similar in some ways, but there's an important difference. So kobolds are definitely kind of the bottom of the humanoid food chain. They get pushed around by everybody bigger than them. And this is meant to be like an illustration of the bad character of orcs. But kobolds have a different response to this fact, right? I mean, the weeniest little guys in the dungeon, nonetheless, kobolds are not using cunning and trickery to run and hide. Kobolds, in fact, are quite aggressive. Their god, Kurtulmak, taught them how to loot and how to ambush. So they're sneaky, but they're still sneaky in a way that provokes confrontation with others. Kurtulmak is a furious giant kobold armed with a spear who hates gnomes worse than anything. But to me, the thing about kobolds is that that incongruity is central. Yes, it makes sense that kobolds should be sneaky little cowards. Well, they are sneaky little cowards, but that kobolds should have a worldview that emphasizes staying out of trouble. They're no good in a fight, and they need to not attract any attention when pretty much anything else that shares the dungeon with them comes through. But that's not how kobolds behave. Kobolds are furious little scrappers, way too aggro for their diminutive stature. They're not rabbits, they're terriers. They do the job on raw aggression and unwillingness to back down, although in fact, not really, because kobolds are as panicky and cowardly as any other low morale monster. I am on record as not really liking Tucker's kobolds very much, and the reason for that is it's very gamey. It requires you to have a super weird view of what kobolds do behind the scene. If they are capable of these kinds of feats of engineering and organization, then why are they still kobolds? Why are you guarding 4 silver pieces in a broken chest? But I do think that this is another side of the underdog deity. If we think of El Herrera as a champion for an entire society of underdogs, one who supports them in their underdogness rather than proving that the underdog can win, or perhaps redefines winning, I guess, then Kurtulmak is another side of that, which is that he is the characteristic little guy big mouth, a skinny little guy whose hot temper doesn't match his actual prowess. Although, I mean, given that his chosen opponent is a Garl Glittergold or whoever, maybe it does. But one of the reasons that I like this other kind of underdog deity is that a conflict is always interesting, and deities who demand that you do something you're not really suited for are pretty common in world religion, but not very common in fantasy religion, right? Typically in fantasy religion, the purpose of a deity is to exemplify traits of the culture it belongs to. We can see this in El Herrera. Rabbits are good at running, hiding, digging, and spotting threats, so El Herrera is the best at running, hiding, digging, and spotting threats. This makes sense in a work of fiction where you are trying to communicate that culture's values. So the stories about the Prince of the Thousand Enemies are told to rabbits to kind of give them the idea of, you know, the right way to behave, just in the same way as they are told to the reader to illuminate the ways in which rabbits see the world differently from humans. So the rabbits in Watership Down evade and endure. They don't see anything wrong with running or hiding, and winning and survival are synonyms. But it's also occasionally nice to contradict that. And another point that I think is interesting about Watership Down, and I think actually in many ways makes it similar to a lot of fantasy games, is that the rabbits have a mythology, but they don't particularly have a religion. By which I mean that they tell these stories, but there's no sense we get that they worship Frith or whoever. They believe that Frith exists, and they believe that Frith is important, but what they don't seem to believe is that anything they do can influence Frith. The relationship goes one way. So they tell these stories as ways of conveying lessons, and they believe that these stories are true, and within the book, I mean, arguably they are true, but that doesn't change how they behave in relation to, like, the numinous. We get the idea that some rabbits are seers, you know, one of the characters in the book, Fiver, kind of has these visions. But again, it's a one-way thing. You know, the visions come to him and then he acts on them or not as he's able to. So there's no sense that rabbits should, like, do or not do something, you know, in order to keep their deities or their ancestors, their spirits, whatever, happy. There's no sense that they have, like, there's no rabbit church. These are stories that they tell, maybe even facts that are true, that ground them in their history and their background, but there's no religious framework that surrounds that. So, talking about Frith, one other thing that a prey species is subject to, of course, you know, that makes a big difference to them is the natural world, right? The changing patterns of weather, of landscape, and so on. And I would expect a fantasy species that had its roots in that kind of life to have some role for the natural world in its mythology. So, I mean, think about how much time humans spend wondering about whether it's going to rain or whether the sun's going to shine, you know, all the things that are going to make agriculture or navigation or whatever possible. These are the factors that allow or disallow these people doing the thing that they do. And so it seems logical that it would be very important to them. Same goes for prey species, right? Predation and survival are very much determined by the environment. So it seems like that would play an important role. And I was thinking about this in kobold terms, and of course, the way that D&D has traditionally presented the religions of non-human species is with a handful of deities or just one. The god of kobolds is Kurtulmak, the god of Kuotoa is Blibdulpulp, the etc. etc. You know what I mean? I understand why it is that way, because otherwise we just have an enormous encyclopedia of deities, but I think it would be nice to have those kinds of natural deities, natural myths for the world that creatures like this live in. Because if you think about kobolds, I was like, oh, well, they won't care about the sun because they typically live underground. They won't have the same kind of nature deities that a surface species would. But actually, I think it could be kind of fun to think about what the spirits and deities that these dungeon-dwelling creatures worship, or at least are aware of, might be. You know, are there spirits or gods of particular underground rivers? Are there deities that correspond to, like, the air currents? You know, you'd have to think about the different air flows throughout your kind of subterranean system. Now, I'm not saying let's map the air flows of this cave system. That kind of naturalistic stuff, not super what I'm interested in. But I do think that you could add a little touch of verisimilitude, I guess, or at least not in Kansas anymore feeling, by mentioning that this is something that these guys care about. Honestly, I know I said earlier that people are sympathetic to the underdog. My portrayal of kobolds as scrappy underdogs is maybe even still as sympathetic as possible, because I think there's another prey species concept, which is, what if your deity doesn't tell you to be content with your lot in life? The rabbits in Watership Down have, like, this awkward relationship with their own status as prey, but there's nothing they can do about it. And indeed, when we see, like, farmed rabbits, that's just another kind of being prey. And farmed rabbits are seen as sort of like they're collaborators. But I think another way to look at a kobold, rather than being like a scrappy underdog, is that kobolds are little bullies. A kobold is not a threat to an adventurer, but they could certainly be a threat towards some villager who has nothing to defend themselves with except, like, a pitchfork or a kitchen knife. If 6 or 7 kobolds with their little spears come into your house, it doesn't matter that you're 3 times their size, they're gonna get you. And so this is just, the sympathetic part of me wants to say, replicating that hierarchy of bullying and oppression, but being oppressed or being in a difficult position doesn't necessarily make people likable or sympathetic, which is also one of the points of Watership Down. They're all in the same boat, but most of the rabbits are a pretty bad lot. So the potential there exists for a certain kind of, like, self-centered meanness, and I think that we could definitely have come up with a deity whose rules justify or can be twisted into the way that kobolds behave, which is to say, cowards in front of the strong, bullies in front of the weak. And of course, this is an often repeated generalization that bullies are very seldom brave. Bullying people is not a brave act. So even if bullies are strong, well, you can be strong without being brave. It's an interesting attempt to create a story in which we have adventure story protagonists who are not brave in the conventional sense because the possibility has been closed off to them. I mean, that's not quite right. They are brave, but they're not brave in the traditional way that an adventure story protagonist would be. The Rabbits of Watership Down inhabit a world that doesn't have rules for combat, if that makes sense. Again, that's not quite right. It's more complex than that, but they have to see the world as a series of tricks and stratagems. It's an interesting way to have a group of player characters look at things. I can't get through this without talking about Bunnies and Burrows. When Bunnies and Burrows first came out, one of the trends among responses to it was people being a little bit disbelieving because this was not in any way a power fantasy. Someone said, you can't do anything. You know, you don't have thumbs. You're not out there like fighting titanic battles. Very interesting. It does have a martial arts system, I think. I'm perfectly frank with you, I've never read Bunnies and Burrows. I've read GURPS Bunnies and Burrows, but the original game I know only by reputation. I believe there is a more recent edition than the one from the 70s, but
I also haven't read that.
But the idea of taking your adventure story protagonists and putting them in a situation where the odds are so completely against them that taking the Weasley way out is understandable, I think can be liberating, right? Someone once said, I want to say Lawrence Schick, said that the thing about Call of Cthulhu is that you can't win by fighting. Because if you could, then if you do win by fighting, the game has degenerated into just monster bashing. And if you don't win by fighting, then you're disappointed. But if you can't win by fighting, then you have to explore other alternatives. You might just have like a horror experience in which you enjoy being scared. Now, the problem with this is that in Call of Cthulhu, you can win by fighting. It's quite a lot of scenarios. The ideal thing to do, like when I was in junior high school, I said, the thing about Call of Cthulhu is that there are lots of monsters that are bulletproof, but there are some monsters that aren't, and therefore you need like an elephant gun. Well, now that I have gone back in editing and deleted that long-winded digression about Call of Cthulhu, I think there is something to be said for A, making the player characters these kinds of can't-win-a-fight underdogs, and allowing them to experience victory and gain rewards for overcoming challenges in what would traditionally be thought of as kind of cop-out or cowardly ways. Second, having them interact with a culture that is like that. So they get to talk to a species who are so, you know, powerless compared to their threats that they have got this kind of run and hide, be the first to notice trouble value system, and they're not just looking for big brave PCs to come fight the monsters. Or third, we take a look at expanding the different ways in which kind of prey cultures or prey species might see their relationship to the cosmos. All right, that is about all the prey gods that I've got time to talk about today. In our next episode, and perhaps the one after that, we are taking a look at a mysterious land of magic and wonder as we go and look at monsters or beings of dreams. So I hope that you will join me then for Monster Man, a show about monsters because monsters are great. Thank you for listening. If you've got a favorite monster or something you'd like me to talk about, why not get in touch? I'm on Twitter as @GonzoHistory, on Mastodon as GonzoHistory@dice.camp, or you can find me on Instagram at MonsterManGonzo, or drop me an email, GonzoHistory@gmail.com. Our theme music is an extract from Solve the Damn Mystery by Jesse Spillane from the album Descent of the Goober Monster and is used under a Creative Commons Attribution License. Our cover art is by Ray Otis. Thanks for listening, and please join me next time for Monster Man, a show about monsters, because monsters are great.